like to open in a word of prayer before I start. Lord, we come before you today. Thank you for this message. Thank you for the words that you spoke to us to guide us and to lead us. I just pray that you would prepare our hearts to accept the message that you have for us, contained throughout your word, a message of salvation, a message of mercy, a message of forgiveness. We thank you for this. We thank you for your death on the cross. Let us never forget that the reason we're here, that the reason that we can be here, is ultimately you. In your name, amen. Good morning. This is, found myself in a little bit of a strange position this past summer. I'm feeling like I did once when I was, actually quite often when I was a little kid. My birthday falls on September 9th. And one thing that children anticipate greatly is their birthday. Very much so. Because you get cake and you get presents and ice cream and whatever you want, and you're the center of attention. And yet I found myself in an ambivalent position every single year. And that's because in the Chicago Public Schools on September 1st or September 3rd, whatever happened to be the day after Labor Day, something else would happen that would invariably come before my birthday, and that would have to come before my birthday in order for my birthday to happen. And nothing else could keep that from happening. And that was the return of school. And one thing that I can remember, that I will remember for the rest of my life, is walking into school on the first day of school and the new school smell. And when you get in there, can you just make a child sick to their stomach? And it's this sort of clean, nice smell, but it's also a smell, and they must have used the same cleaner every year, but the sort of smell that says you're here now, you're going to be here for the next 1,000 days of what it felt like, right? And so be ready to learn. And you had to get used to your new teacher's personality. And you had to meet the new kids. And the new kids would come in and they would shuffle the social order in the classroom. And so you never knew where you were going to fall at that point when you got there. And, you know, there was always things that were happening and catching up with everyone and being shy. And I was like, and so this summer, my wife and I get to go on vacation. For the first time in 3 years, we're going to be able to go on vacation by ourselves. And yet I've had to come and deliver this sermon first. So you can see the analogy here. I've had this great thing I'm looking forward to. I'm excited about it. I'm happy about it. And that old school smell is coming back. And in a way, this has a bit to do with the sermon this morning, with our passage, because it deals with anticipation. It deals with anticipation in a way where we look forward to something, to a future event. Now, I wasn't necessarily looking forward to this morning, and unless you have a very interesting child, they don't necessarily look forward to the first day of school. But we're looking forward to something in our future as a church, as a people of God. And that is His imminent return. And so the parable I'd like to present to you today deals with this issue. It deals with His imminent return. And this is a special set of parables because these, I feel, are parables. These aren't evangelistic parables, although there is, you can take this application in for non-Christians. But these are parables for you and for I. These are parables for the disciples, for us as Christians, in anticipation of His imminent return. With that said, I'd like to say that there are some other side issues that come into these parables. There are issues of reward. There are issues of consequence. Now, I feel that these issues, while they are important, they are not the main issue here. And it's easy to get stuck on these things. It's easy to get stuck on the punishment aspect or on the consequences aspect of these parables, because they're significant to us. It makes us wonder about things. But what I'd really like to challenge you this morning is to not worry about that, not to think about that, but to think about the anticipation, to think about what we need to do. The parable specifically is the faithful and the unfaithful slave in Matthew chapter 24, 45. But this parable falls in a section, in a part of a sermon that he gives on the Mount of Olives that begins before it. And so we have to go back to verse 36 to really understand what he's talking about. Now here's another reason why these parables are interesting. In a lot of parables, Jesus doesn't necessarily explain what he means. In a lot of parables, he will explain what he means afterwards, but here, he's explicit. And that's part of what makes this a little bit more difficult of a sermon to say, because it's hard to say something that's going to clarify what Christ says, because he is so explicit at the beginning of this section of this sermon. He's going to come out and explain everything that he's going to teach about. Let's read together again, just to read it. Verse 36 to 44. But about that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, and one will be taken and one will be left. So stay awake. Be alert, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. This is really the beginning, the introduction to a set of three parables, and then some more at the end, or from the middle of chapter 25 to the end, some instruction on the last days and the end times that he gives. And it's really a trilogy of parables, and each of the parables deal with the same issue in a different way. We have the faithful and the unfaithful slave, working or not working in anticipation of their master's return. We have the 10 bridesmaids in anticipation or not in anticipation of the bridal couple's return or coming home to the feast. And we have the parable of the talents, of the three servants who are working or not working in anticipation of their master's return. We're probably not going to get to the last two parables, but I'll try to give an overview of those, simply because there's a lot of material here, and I'd like to just get the basic concepts down. But let's take a look at this section, verse 36 to 44, and it's where Christ is explaining everything, and I call this the prologue to this three set of parables. And what is a prologue? A prologue is sort of like an introduction that an author gives to a narrative or to an essay or to something that he's going to write to help instruct the reader and to help the reader understand. And so it's sort of like a foundation. If you're going to write about something heady and something intellectual, you might want to write a basic foundation. Clarify some of the terms that you're going to use. You might introduce some of the history. A lot of history books will have a prologue that deal with the events that transpired before and led up to it. One of the most famous prologues in literature is the prologue to the Canterbury Tales, in which Chaucer introduces an immense cast of characters, and he describes them in great, sometimes humorous detail, and gives illustrations of their personality so that we can understand why they're telling the story that they tell, for instance. Or why they don't tell the story that they tell, for instance. A lot of people are familiar with some of the more, ribald tales from the Canterbury Tales. But there's also a sermon in the Canterbury Tales given by a character called the Poor Country Parson. And in order for us to understand why he's not going to tell a story, Chaucer will illustrate this character in the prologue. And he'll set up the plot line for the general story that binds all these stories together. These pilgrims who are on their way to a holy shrine in England, and that they're telling these stories as entertainment to each other. And so we can understand what the basis is. It's not just a strange collection of stories. So here Jesus Christ is giving us a prologue, a foundation on which we can build our understanding when he tells us the rest of the story. And the prologue will clarify and enlighten us, and then he'll go back and he'll tell the stories to sort of build upon that and to make it more concrete. Now, if we look at this prologue, it seems to be that Jesus presents sort of a thesis. Now, we don't speak of Jesus presenting a thesis, because a thesis may be something that may or may not be true, and it's something you defend. But here he's presenting a truth, that he's coming back, and we don't know when. And if you look, he really repeats that almost three times. In verse 36, he says, "But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son of Man, but only the Father." And then in verse 37, he says, "So stay awake, because you don't know on what day your Lord is coming." And then on verse 44, he says, So you also must be ready," not almost ready, "you must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour." And you know, again, he brings it up in 25. If you look in 25:13 at the end of the parable of the bridesmaid, "Keep awake, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." With these three statements, these three truths that Jesus, this one truth really that he restates over and over again, he's going to give us some illustrations here in the prologue, and really the parables are illustrations to clarify this. If we look at verse 37, he says, "For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man." We can see here, to a certain extent, there's an issue of preparation. If we go back and we read the story of Noah in Genesis, we see that God gave Noah a command to build an ark and to gather animals and to save the righteous, who really number 2-8 people, Noah's family. And Noah is really faced with a choice, isn't he? Now, a lot of times we think when God speaks to us, we're not really faced with a choice. But when we really think about it, God gives us a lot of commands that we regard as choices, don't we? Especially when we're tempted by sin. He gives us a lot of instruction that we see as choices. And Noah has a choice to live as though he believes the flood is coming. And if he's going to live as though he believes the flood is coming, what is he going to do? He's going to build an ark. He's going to gather animals. He's going to make provisions for the flood based on the word of God that the flood is coming. The people also have a choice. We know that Noah told them the flood was coming because the people asked him, "Why are you building the ark?" They see this guy building this boat. You know that's got to be awkward for Noah. You know that he doesn't want people to think he's crazy. Right? He's building this great big ark. And his neighbors come up to him, wine jug in hand, Bermuda shorts on, flip-flops, Hawaiian shirt, saying, "Noah, it's the middle of the summer. Why are you working so hard building this ark? What are you doing? You're sweaty. You need to relax." And no doubt Noah wanted to. And then Noah has to say, "Well, you know, I was told that a flood was coming, and basically we're all doomed unless we get in the boat. And now the people, they've heard the truth. And they're going to live or not live based on whether or not they've accepted the truth from Noah or not. If we look at verse 38, we can see the outcome. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. They went about their lives regular, no different than before. Probably on the day the flood came, the guy was sitting out there in his lawn chair with his flip-flops and his wine jug and his Bermuda shorts, happy that the clouds are coming and stop the sun from beating down and that he's going to get some shade. Going about his daily life like nothing was different. They made a choice. They knew, or they had heard, the reality. And they made a choice to live according to the reality or to deny the reality, to not live according to the reality. Noah also made this choice, and we would say he made the correct choice. He knew it was coming, and his life showed his faith. His life showed his trust in the Lord. If we go on to verse 40, we get it clarified even a little bit more, and this adds an interesting element to it. Verse 40, then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. So a lot of expositors think this is about the rapture, which it may be. I actually read one commentator who added a little different twist, and that those who disappeared were not the righteous, but they were the unrighteous that were judged and were gone, therefore. Now, this is a reference to the following period of Christ's kingdom. But there's an issue here, I think, of suddenness. There's an issue here, I think, of irrevocableness. It can't be taken back. It happens suddenly. And it's something we don't always get from the story of Noah, because we realize that Noah built the ark for years. But there's an issue here now of suddenness. The people didn't know or didn't recognize the coming of the Lord. It says that there were two who were working in the fields. There could be one man who's plowing and another man throwing grain. And the next minute we know the one throwing the grain is looking down and walking the lawn and he bumps into the plow. Where'd the other guy go? He's gone. There wasn't a sign that he recognized. It was just all of the sudden. Two women are grinding grain together. And all of a sudden, the one realizes it's a lot harder to push the millstone or to, you know, in some cases they would have animals pushing the millstone around. It was, you know, so-and-so was supposed to be watching the donkey push the millstone around, and now she's gone. Where'd she go? It's sudden. They didn't know it was coming. There weren't any second chances. There weren't any great big warning signs that they could understand and that they could comprehend. It was sudden. We don't know the day. We don't know the hours. Now, there's certainly prophecy, and I'm not going to get into prophecy now. One of the commentators said that because the passage says we don't know the day and we don't know the hour, some people who are familiar with prophecy may be able to know the year. And I think that may be following the letter of the passage and not necessarily the spirit of the passage. You know, in the ancient world, they had, whenever something cataclysmic was going to happen, or not necessarily happen, but whenever they would think that something cataclysmic was going to happen, they would believe in omens. And they would have these guys called augurs who would read the omens so that if a comet appeared in the sky, they would say, destruction's coming to our civilization. What can we do? There's no comet in the sky here for these people. It's sudden.
It comes without warning. Later on, he's going to talk about it being like a thief who comes in the night. There's no sign. There's no warning. So now we get to the meaty issue. If we read through 42, which again we said that's his statement of truth here. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. And if we go to 43, but understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Here we find Christ is using almost a logical argument of sorts. He's presenting to the disciples something that's very reasonable, isn't it? Taking a simple idea, that is, a thief coming and breaking in, and he's saying, look, what would you do if you knew that a thief was going to break into your house? You would make preparations, wouldn't you? You would bar the door or lock the door. You would leave lights on so that people would be home. You would let the dogs out, if you have large dogs, so that they would raise a ruckus and scare the man away. You would hide your valuables. You might hide your family. You might have your family stay somewhere else. You might get your biggest, ugliest, toughest friends to sit in the dark and wait for the time when this character tries to climb through your window. You would call the authorities. You'd let the police know. You wouldn't sit and do nothing. You wouldn't just sit and wait and think, oh my gosh, I'm going to get robbed. What am I going to do? No. You're going to do something. You're going to get ready. You're going to get prepared. The only question is, what are you going to do? This is an interesting, this is just a little aside. This is the sort of thing that I find interesting. A gentleman named Lockyer, whose book was extremely useful to me, it's called All the Parables of the Bible. He calls this an embryonic parable. A parable like a little baby parable, a parable that's not developed into a story, into a strict narrative, but it's an idea that's a grain of a parable. He says you could imagine the Lord developing this into a full story. Let's say Thomas doesn't quite get it this time. Well, the Lord later on might develop this into a full story. And there's other embryonic parables too. He talks about the blind leading the blind. There's not really a story about a blind man walking down a road trying to lead another blind man, and then they end up in a ditch or end up stepping in something that they don't want to step in, or end up running into a camel or some other similar hazard that they might encounter in the Middle East. These embryonic parables he just uses to illustrate his main point. I just also wanted to use the word embryonic in my sermon. But this is a key portion in this prologue, because it deals with the thing that's understood in the story about Noah, that he prepares, that he lives like he believes the flood is coming. It's an important because it goes with that passage about the people being raptured or being judged, because it shows the suddenness that a criminal can strike. And it gets into that idea of being prepared. What are you going to do to be prepared when the burglar comes? If you think about it, we do a lot of things in our culture to prepare for the eventuality or the potentiality of crime, don't we? We lock our doors at night. We invest in car security systems or in home security systems, or we get a stereo that you can take out of your car or some other thing. Even with computers these days, you have to have a special type of program that will prevent people who aren't supposed to be looking at your information from looking at your information. So now not only do we have thieves who physically break in and steal, but we have thieves who electronically break in and steal. We do a lot of things. We live our lives as if we believe at any moment someone could come in our house and take our valuables or harm our family. Why? Because it's important to us. Our families are important that they not be harmed. Our valuables are important because they give us some measure of comfort in our lives. And so we operate, I mean, also the fact that there are people out there who will do this. But if it wasn't important to us, we wouldn't care if people would come in and steal our stuff. We operate from almost a position of faith that says people could come in and break in. We don't know that they're going to break in. We operate from a position of faith that says people are going to come in and break in, and so I need to live my life in a way that I believe that this is real. So we take these precautions. You can ask my wife if I make sure I lock the door every night before I go to bed. I live in Wheaton, but I grew up in the city of Chicago. And if I check and make sure that the windows are locked, or if I hear a noise, I have to get up and go see what it was. I'm preparing. I'm living by faith that this could happen. You see how Jesus has taken this prologue and he has explicitly explained the coming of the Son of Man to his disciples before he's even really opened up the parables. Before he's even really presented these parables that might be hard to understand to his disciples, he's taken this prologue and he's taken the time in this prologue to present it to them so that they are sure going to understand it. He doesn't want there to be any misunderstandings. He's not going to make any cryptic phrases here. He's not going to play word games with these guys. And I'm assuming it was the disciples. It could have been more. It could have been another, a little bit larger but closer-knit group of people. But he wants us to understand that when he says he's coming again and we need to be prepared, he wants us to understand that's what he means. We need to be prepared. We need to have some idea of what we're doing in order to get prepared. We need to have some inkling that if we believe that he's coming, that we live like we believe that he's coming. One of the commentators says, the inward kingdom reality will be reflected in our outward living reality. That if we have it inside us and we believe that he's coming inside us, we will live like we believe that he's going to come. To a certain extent, that's a little bit of a harangue maybe, or a little bit of a threat, as in, if you're a Christian, you better live. I don't think that's what he's saying. I don't think he's saying that in order to be a Christian, you need to live like you believe. Last week, Chris presented to us the story of the rich young ruler, and he pointed out that the rich young ruler's forfeit of salvation didn't come from the fact that he didn't want to give up his riches and his wealth. That was just a reflection of what was inside. It was a reflection of his unwillingness to accept the message to come and follow me. It's hard at this point for me to go on because I think Christ has explained it so very well. He's given us this introduction, and it's clear we need to be prepared. But just so that it's maybe a little bit more lurid for the disciples, just so that it's a little bit more clear, now he's going to open up with a trilogy of parables that will give specific, concrete examples. And there's no break anywhere here. There's no narrative break anywhere between any of these parables. He will speak to the end of chapter 25 before the author of the gospel then says, describe something Jesus did, before the author of the gospels will explain something else that Jesus did. So this is a unity. This is a thematic and narrative unity that Jesus Christ is presenting to us. So these go together. We can look at verse 45 and how verse 45 starts. Who then is the faithful and wise slave whom his master has put in charge of his household to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time? And so that's why we have to look back at the prologue. We have to figure out what he's meaning when he says then, right? Who then is the faithful and wise slave whom his master has put in charge of his household to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave when his master will, whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. But if that wicked slave says to himself, my master is delayed, and he begins to beat his fellow slaves, and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know. He will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. See, there's the hard part at the end, right? And that's the part that the commentators like to wrestle with, and they like to put their ideas out, because in some ways they feel that that might contradict salvation by faith and not by works. And, it doesn't. There's enough explanations there that they offer that it won't contradict that. And if you take the time to delve into that, if you pick your favorite commentator and look for what he has to say, you'll be comforted. And the issue here, though, isn't this punishment. The issue here isn't rewards, in my opinion. The issue is preparedness. The issue is the return is imminent. What are you doing to get ready? The master is coming back to claim his household. What are you going to do to be ready? It's really good. I'm an English major. I love literature. There's a really good story about a master who comes home and who punishes wicked servants and who rewards righteous servants. And it comes from a very odd place. But towards the end of the epic poem, The Odyssey, Odysseus comes back to Ithaca. It's actually a touching scene and a tender scene where in disguise as sort of this doddering old beggar who is walking on three legs because he's got a cane and who's half hunched over, and he walks into his fields and his old dog recognizes him despite his disguise and runs up to him and falls dead because now his master's come back and he can die. And some of Odysseus's servants have been living in anticipation of their master's return, and some of them haven't. And so the shepherds have been faithful to their master. Ironically enough, it's the goat herd. And this isn't biblical now, the sheep and the goats, but it's the goat herd who's the one who has been giving away his master's possessions, who's been giving these suitors who are trying to marry Odysseus' wife his wine and his food and his gold. See, he wants to get in good with whoever's going to be the next big enchilada in the house. Now, Odysseus is not Jesus Christ, so his judgment is a bit more severe. And the servants who weren't looking out for their master's interests, they don't make it, I'm sad to say. It's a good example of this idea of this master going on a journey and coming back. Why did the master go on a journey in this parable? We don't know. To raise business, perhaps. He seems like a wealthy man. He seems like he may have been a merchant. Perhaps he was a teacher of the law. Perhaps he was doing an itinerant series of sermons around a region, and he was doing exposition as a guest speaker. And when he goes, he puts his slaves in charge. He takes one of his favorite slave, his best slave, his slave who's like a friend. Maybe the slave whose ear he's pierced with an awl because the time came for him to let him go, and the slave said, no, I don't want to go. But he takes the slave and says, here's some money, Here's the resources. I've got to go. You've got to stand in for me. And I'm coming back real soon, though. And so you watch over the family. It says here the household. When we think of a household in antiquity, it wasn't just the family. The household was the owner's family, but then it was also the slaves. And so take care of everybody while I'm gone. Give them the food that they need. Make sure that everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing. Don't let Frank fall asleep when he's supposed to be plowing. Don't let George get into the food when he's not supposed to get into the food. Take care of my house. So the master goes away, and here's where the story diverges. Here's where the parable diverges. We can have a faithful and wise servant who attends to his master's business. It says in verse 46, "Blessed is that slave whom the master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions." Yes, this is victory for the slave. He's kept his promises. He's followed through on his obligations. He's done everything he's supposed to do. You know, I mean, within reason. This is a simple story, right? He may have slept late once or twice, but for the most part, when the master comes back, he finds him at work. Wonderful. The master's proud. I imagine this slave, like the slave we would call the paedagogos, or who's the teacher for the children in the household, the old man or the old woman who would come and who they would pay, who they would buy, and the slave would come and teach these children. It was an educated slave. And if this was a religious family, they would get an educated slave who would come and teach them the stories of their faith. And he would teach them mathematics, and sort of like a nanny and a teacher combined. But a wise older person who had gone through life and who would take care, who you could count on to take care of this family. Well, the story diverges here, and we get the unfaithful slave, the foolish slave. We look at the description of the foolish slave. "But that wicked slave says to himself," this is verse 48, "but that wicked slave says to himself, 'My master is delayed.'" This guy's not an atheist, is he? He knows his master's coming back. He just says, "My master's delayed. I have some time. I can goof off a little bit, and no one will be the wiser, because when my master comes back, I'll make sure that everything is okay." Some of you know that my wife has been at camp the past week. And I tend to let dishes pile up. And the clothes don't all make it into the hamper. That certainly doesn't get made every morning. And I might leave some lights on. I'm not a slob. I'm just a little bit creative in my organization. But it's okay, because so long as the house is clean when she comes home, so long as there's not vermin scurrying across the counter, then I'm all right. Right? If I vacuum the floor and get the crumbs off the floor, and everything's okay. This is sort of that reasoning that slave has, isn't it? You know what? Today, it's real hot. I'm not going to go out and work in the field. And that jerk Willie's really getting on my nerves. He's not getting his food today. And I'm going to take the money that my master gave me for the slave. You know what? We all ate yesterday. We don't need to eat today. And since I got into the wine last week, there's nothing here. I got to go to the tavern. And the slave goes into town and he starts to live it up and he starts to party. Because his master is delayed. This is the slave I think of as a younger person. Not this older, respected person, but a younger person who still believes that they have life, that they have living that they need to do. And these are just gross stereotypes, and I apologize, but this is what I picture. And the master's coming through town, and he's coming through the marketplace, and he's on his way home, when out of the tavern stumbles this wreck of humanity. He smells like he hasn't bathed in weeks, and who's been drinking at least for the past 8 hours. And not on his own coin, but on his master's coin. And he comes out of the tavern at this inopportune time and falls at his master's feet, and his master's a nice guy, and he helps him up. And then he recognizes through the stubble and the red eyes and the thick breath this man, and he says, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here? You're supposed to be at home. You're supposed to be taking care of our family. You're not supposed to be here. Where'd you get that money? Where'd you get those clothes? Those look like they used to be some of my clothes." You can see the disappointment in the master's eyes. And you can see some sadness. You know how it is when someone you love doesn't live up to your expectations? Now, yes, we have to forgive them on the one hand, but on the other hand, what a disappointment. I've been there my share of times. Not on the disappointed side, on the disappointing side. I'm sure we all have. I'm sure we also know that pain. I don't think that the slavery that they talk about, the servanthood, was like what happened in the antebellum South, where they were just property. These were valued, close, dear members of a household. The master comes back, and he doesn't find the servant at work. He doesn't find the servant attending to his business. You see, there were these two slaves, or really one slave with a choice, right? And the slaves have lived their lives according to the inward reality of their faith. And the first slave's faith was, "My master could return at any time. Let me be about his business." And the second slave said, "My master's delayed. Let me be about his purse and his coins." You know what? There's something else there. There's an issue of affection, isn't there? There's an issue of respect. An issue of love. We had to ask ourselves which servant had affection for his master, which servant had a true abiding love for his master. We would say it was the first. You're not saved by your works. But many, many, many times, your actions are the reflection of what's in your heart. When I was growing up, I took piano lessons. I don't play piano anymore, so I can't do hymns. There's a specific technique you have to learn to play hymns, and it's very hard, and I didn't learn it. There was something that you'd go through every year called the National Piano Guild Auditions. You didn't know when they were going to be. You just knew you had to do it. And you would go through the year sort of in a half-baked, half-vague anticipation of these National Piano Guild auditions. And you really didn't know when they were at the beginning of the year. In fact, I didn't practice the piano June, July, and August. You see, I was at Lake Geneva Youth Camp. They don't have pianos there. But these, you would go into this room with this judge, and this judge would take a look at different things. I remember some of the comments I got when I was younger. Because, you know, when you're little, the judge is dealing with you on issues, on little stylistic things. You know, they write up a report card and they say, Joel needs to make sure he washes his hands before he sits down at the piano. And then you would get a little bit older and you'd get a little bit more serious about the music. Because when you're little, it's about the discipline of sitting down at the piano every day and learning to train your fingers. But when I got older, then it would be other things. Joel needs to not slouch at the keyboard. He does his scales very well. He needs to work on his chords. And then when you get a little bit older, it's a little bit more technical, right? He needs to be able to, he got a little flustered. And he had to go back to the beginning of the song and start over. So what he needs to do these next 3 months of June, July, and August is practice starting over that song in different spots. He needs to be able to pick it up at any measure, on any beat, and be able to play the rest of the song. Yeah, good luck. We didn't know when these Piano Guild auditions were. Well, let me tell you, that was a hard thing to be a little kid and have to go sit in front of this strange person. We didn't know when these National Piano Guild auditions were, but we would practice. Because you knew it was coming. It was also a recital. And so your best piece, your piece that you got your highest marks on, then my piano teacher had such a piano teacher name. Her name was Miss Bird. And she would give a recital, and we'd sit in her living room, and after the recital, we'd drink punch and eat cake that always had strawberries in the middle. But before then, you had to go through this National Piano Guild audition. And sit in a room with a piano and a judge who wasn't your mother or your father or your piano teacher, who wouldn't remind you to wash your hands or sit up, who would tell you, okay, that's enough, right when you were getting to the best part of the song, and tell you to go on to something else. You see, we had to learn to practice like we believed that the Piano Guild auditions were coming. We had to get ready. My heart wasn't in it. That's why I don't play the piano today. It was hard. I didn't care for it. My father, more 9 times out of 10, had to catch me to get me to practice the piano. And he would have to sit there, and it became a chore for him and I, this contest of wills. And at the time, I thought he was giving me a lot of grief, and I was giving him a lot of grief. But that's the idea of preparing, getting yourself ready. It's very explicit to me that we need to be ready, that our lives need to reflect what's in our hearts. We're not saved by works. But 9 times out of 10, the faith that's in our heart is reflected in our actions. What are you going to do to be ready? The Master's coming back very soon. I don't know the day or the hour. I can't tell you when. I'm not a prophecy buff. I can't tell you the year either. He's coming back. Are you ready? This is where I think it comes in. For the non-Christian as well, for the non-believer, because, see, they have to do something even more elemental than the believer does. They have to make sure that they've accepted Christ as their Lord and Savior. They have to make sure that they are part of the household. As a Christian, our job is to be prepared. If we had time to go on to look at the parable of the 10 bridesmaids and the parable of the talents, we would see that Christ gets a little bit more specific in these two parables. In the parable of the bridesmaids, the ten bridesmaids, five foolish and five wise, are set in anticipation of the bridegroom, of the bridal party, coming. And they have, there's five with enough oil for their lamps and five without enough oil. And it's a really interesting story, because if you look at it, the only thing that separates the two of them, or the set, the two sets, are the, who's got the oil, who planned to have the enough oil, and who didn't. They're all dressed up. They all have their lamps. They all fall asleep. But when the shout comes, those who are ready are the ones who had the presence and the forethought to get their oil and to have their lamps ready. And now this deals with what I think is the inward, whether you're cultivating your Christian character, whether you are looking to your heart, looking towards the inward things in your heart and trying to take care of yourself inside. A lot of commentators think that the oil has to do with the Holy Spirit, and that those without the oil represent those who, I'm not going to look it up, but who have a Christian profession, but no possession. They don't possess Christ. And that this is a parable representing the end of the church age, and this is I like this image of the sifting of the church. When those who just have the profession are separated from those who have the profession as the possession. And there's some other applications for that parable that you can look at. I would really ask you to read these parables and to read the discourse following. And then if you go into the next parable, we have the parable of the talents, and that's the parable of waiting and working. So if the parable of the bridesmaids is waiting and watching, and the parable is waiting and working, and their work doesn't reflect their heart. And we have the one pathetic servant who doesn't invest, not because he only has one talent, not because he's afraid, but because he's lazy, because he's slothful. And so this is some of the commentators say that the one flows into the other. He puts the one about the inward life before the one about the outward life, because the outward life flows from the inward life. And that seems like a reasonable assertion. But take a look at these passages and read them and consider, what are you doing to get ready? The master of the household is coming back. He's going to clean house. And does the inward reality of your life reflected in your actions? I'll close in prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this solemn passage, which is hard for us to read on the one hand, but at the same time is necessary for us to hear. And we know that we're saved by your grace and by your love, and let us show that back to you through our actions. Let us cultivate our lives so that we can show you how much we love you. You said in your word, if we love you, we'll keep your commandments, and so help us to do that. You said to the apostle, if you love me, feed my sheep. And he did love you, and he did feed your sheep. Help us to be like the apostle. Help us to love you in our actions. as well as in word. Help us to be like the faithful servant whose inner heart is reflected in his action. Help us to be like the wise bridesmaids whose life is full of the Spirit and who are able to join you because they have you. Help us to be like the diligent servants who labor for you and for your kingdom. Not with the expectation of reward or with added responsibility, but out of affection, out of gratitude, out of love for our fellow man. We thank you. We ask your blessing on this day in your name. Amen.